Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. I am Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we want to continue from a previous episode where we started talking about the American Diabetes Association Standards of Care, which get updated every year. And now we have the 2024 Standards of Care. Even though it's December 2023, they always come out early, which is fantastic. Great holiday reading. And so we want to talk about a few topics that we thought were really, really interesting that were updated this year. And so the first one we'd like to highlight is related to hypoglycemia and glucagon. And in fact, this was so updated that Section 6 actually has a whole new name that it is now called glycemic targets and hypoglycemia. So, Natalie, do you mind sharing some of the updates that happened related to hypoglycemia awareness?
Absolutely. So the glycemic goals and hypoglycemia section 6, the recommendation was updated to include more frequent glycemic assessment by populations needing closer glycemic monitoring. You know, a lot of let's take Medicare, for example. What does that mean? Medicare will allow us to do an A1C every 90 days. Well, what if we make significant changes and we want to know in between? Medicare might not pay for that evaluation. So the ADA is saying, well, that makes no sense because we're looking also to help people feel like they're making progress. So let's say I have an A1C of 9 and we changed 3 different things and we've made some progress, but we still can't do the evaluation for 3 more months. I think that becomes really, it's a hard thing to wait 90 whole days. So could we do one in the middle? Yes, we do it. But if Medicare won't cover it, it's a hard one, right? So that's kind of where the discussion is. The ADA is again and again making person-centric decisions here and saying, this might not be right for everyone. This waiting that 90-day time frame or however long it is based on different insurance companies versus the person sitting in front of us. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, definitely. And another one of the things that I've just seen this section has really evolved over the years to where it's including more time in range. It's got the ambulatory glucose profile. But especially new for 2024 is now there's a table about the different glucagon formulations. And while this has been mentioned in previous versions, the reality is that the last few years, we really exploded with new glucagon, that we have a nasal glucagon, Baqsimi. We now have prefilled injectable forms. We've got Gvoke and dasiglucagon, Zegalog. And so those are much easier to use options than the traditional emergency glucagon kit that was so difficult to use and probably definitely contributed to under-prescribing of glucagon. And so I'm glad to see that it's really called out the importance of assessing for hypoglycemia, but also that we do have these various options and we should be trying to facilitate that people have access to these easier to use options.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think, you know, you and I had a poster with several other people a couple of years ago at ATTD where we looked at data from one of the continuous glucose sensing companies and the percent of our patients that had lots of hypoglycemia and what percent of them actually had a glucagon prescription on file within the last 12 to 18 months. And it was woefully inadequate would be the way I would describe it. And that was, you know, looking at our own patient populations. I think that with the newer formulations, it is hopefully changing. Every person who has in uses a medication that can cause hypoglycemia. So that would be insulin, sulfonylureas, those kinds of medications should have glucagon. And, you know, I think the one of the challenges is people will say, well, I've never had to use it. But it's an emergency treatment. The goal is you never need it, but that you have it in case you do need it.
Yeah, exactly. And I also like that there's another table that's been added to really assess hypoglycemia risk, especially amongst people that are taking insulin or sulfonylureas or meglitinides, all medications that we know contribute to hypoglycemia. And so it calls out some different like clinical and biological risk factors, like things like end-stage kidney disease, if someone's got other diabetes, complications like retinopathy, neuropathy, cardiovascular disease, but also perhaps some risk factors like food insecurity or homelessness or lower health literacy or alcohol or substance use. And so I think calling these out will hopefully guide clinicians that these are important things to assess. And hopefully by addressing these different factors or taking people off of medications like sulfonylureas and the glitinides whenever possible. We can't always take people off of insulin, especially if they're type 1, but we can definitely try to take off those other medications and switch to ones that don't cause hypoglycemia.
And if we need to use them appropriately and make sure that these people have medications to treat, you know, very little extra insulin can cause big problems. I think that's how we have to think about it. Someone dials up 10 instead of, you know, or they give rapid acting instead of their long acting, that can cause serious problems. So this is again, very well written, but also very concise. I love the table because it's very, and you know, in our practice, I don't know how you do it. I typically show them both the nasal as well as the epi-like pen. And I say, which one would you rather? And I start there. And then insurance occasionally will dictate which one I'm allowed, which is less expensive for the person in front of me. But a lot of times they can pick. And so having samples in the office also helps. They're not real. They don't provide real samples, but they do provide demos that we can show people how to use them, which I also think helps more with comfort so someone would actually actuate and use it. Right. It doesn't do any good if it's sitting in a box. I think that's another clinical insight show them how to use it in the office before they walk out the door.
Yeah. And hopefully get them comfortable so that they could show the people around them that would potentially be using it so that they're comfortable. So I absolutely agree. Yeah. I'm a fan of having, and they're easy to show people. It takes less than a minute to just show.
Right.
They can see. Absolutely. And one other comment, I just like to remind people, we've got continuous glucose monitoring, which definitely helps to reduce hypoglycemia, but it does not eliminate hypoglycemia. As great as the alerts are, with our current insulins and our current therapies, unfortunately, hypoglycemia is still a reality. So much to the point that our guidelines say the goal for time spent less than 70 is less than 4%. For the time less than 54, it's less than 1%. Is that 0%? Is that, it's hard to believe. Well, we say up to 3.9% of the time under 70 is meeting the goal, right?
Which is an hour a day. We have to think about that, right? An hour a day. And so I think that's where you bring in those people with other things going on, right? They've got some background retinopathy. What is that signal? That signals that they may not feel their lows the same way, right? They've got some kidney disease. That insulin can stay in the body longer and act. It's like, I tell them, it's like more potential for the same thing because it doesn't eliminate the insulin the same way. You have a higher risk. You become more insulin sensitive. You need less of it. You can have more lows. Those kinds of things are the reasons why we should, as clinicians, be thinking about prescribing glucagon. But in the end, anyone on insulin, anyone on a sulfur, any of the drugs that cause low glucoses, we should think about it. Immediately, this is something that should go with those drugs hand in hand.
Absolutely. Yeah. So some other kind of switching gears a little bit, because there's so many good updates this year, but section 4, I felt like also had some pretty good updates in that. So section 4 is actually the it's the Comprehensive Medication Evaluation and Assessment of Comorbidities. And so this section definitely has been updated in terms of like immunizations and everything. So of course, COVID is recommended, that vaccine for people with diabetes, but also now there's new information on RSV and recommending that for certain people with diabetes. But what I was particularly impressed with was now this new section on bone health. So we think of, in the past, like, of course, we want people's eyes screened and foot care and assessment of kidney disease and cardiovascular disease. But now this is really calling out for bone health and assessing that. So Natalie, if you want to share any of the kind of new updates related to the bone health.
Hey, we have to pause because I'm pulling it up right now.
Oh, sorry. I can do it.
No, it's fine. I'm just looking for it now. Oh, bone health. Here we go. I'm sorry.
I just did a control F for bone health. Yeah.
Yep. No, I was paging through because I wanted to see if there's anything else, right? Okay. So sorry about that, Patrick. I hate when you have to cut things because of me, right? So bone health, right? Section 4. This is completely new and really well written as well. Fracture risk should be assessed in older adults with diabetes as part of routine care in diabetes clinical practice according to risk factors and comorbidities. So what does that actually mean, right? We need to get an x-ray. We need to do a DEXA scan. And look people with diabetes and every 2 to 3 years. So we should consider adverse impact on bone health when we're looking at medications. And I think sometimes we go to, let's get this done. We got to get this A1C down. We got to drive things down. But we don't think about, okay, where is this? Every drug has side effects and every class of drugs has side effects. So I think we need to think about bone health when we're looking at the person in front of us. So again, though, what else? When our brains are designed to drive that A1C down. But as people age, and we've talked a lot about this when we talk about time and range and reassessing goals as people age and getting that time in target and that time below target to zero, that time in below target, why? Because as soon as someone falls and breaks a hip, they don't end up back where they are where they started the majority of the time. So low glucose is cause someone to get dizzy. They trip and fall on a rug that shouldn't have been in the house in the first place, and they break a bone. Now they end up in a different trajectory for aging than they would without it. So again, the hypoglycemia, we don't think about hypoglycemia and fractures, but that really is a hand-in-hand thought process and medical trajectory that we really need to be careful of. So when we look back at time in range and time below range, that time below range we were just talking about is less than 4%, you know, in individuals, except as people age, it goes to zero. We want no hypoglycemia. So we actually increase the time above range in order to compensate for getting rid of all hypoglycemia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just being aware of like medications like the TZDs, pioglitazone, can increase that risk of bone fractures. Also, like you said, just trying to be cautious about hypoglycemia because that can increase the person's risk of having falls. So this is just all part of that comprehensive assessment. And that's why I love working in diabetes because it's so much more than just diabetes. Like it's so much more than just glucose levels. It's really, it's everything, even bone health. So I want to just also comment on the vaccines because that gets updated every year as well. And we've seen how the standards do a great job of making sure they stay updated according to kind of the national vaccine recommendations. And so one of the updates this year was that RSV, that vaccine became FDA approved last June, and now it's recommended for adults over the age of 60. And so that's been incorporated into these guidelines as well, that adults also with diabetes recommended over the age of 60. And then also COVID-19 vaccine recommended for any person with diabetes over 6 months of age. So and then last year, actually for 2023, the pneumococcal was updated, but just reminding people that we do have new pneumococcal vaccines, or I guess they're over a year old, but those guidelines have kind of changed where it used to be like the 23 and the 13, and now we have the 15 and the 20 are preferred. So it's all in section 4. And there's also a great mobile app that goes with it too, to keep it straight, because it's a lot to keep straight, but there is a beautiful chart that guides you on what vaccines are recommended for people.
And I think that's a really good place to talk about the standards of care app too. So the ADA does have a standards of care app. No one can keep all this together. For our listeners, for clinicians, and you go, oh my gosh, how do you keep all this together? You don't. But as you practice it, you think, okay, what about, you know, immunizations? Where do I need to go? That kind of thing. I think that the app, I have all of the students, all of the residents, all of the fellows, we all download it. We look things up together, and that really does help.
I totally agree. So the other area that I wanted to talk about, and there's so much. I mean, people dedicate whole webinars and courses to talking about the updates to the standards of care. So we're not going to do all of that justice, but I wanted to make sure we talked about the weight management. So Section 8, that has obviously exploded this year. We've had a lot of episodes related to the incretins. And of course, we've got now tirzepatide, which is FDA approved for weight management and Zepbound. And we've got semaglutide, Wegovy, and liraglutide, Saxenda. So we now actually have three of these therapies. And what I thought was really great, there's several great things in this section, but that they called out that first line therapy for weight management should be either a GLP-1 agonist or the dual GLP-GIP agonist. And that might seem like, oh, well, of course, they're really effective. Like, what's the big deal on that? Well, I feel like it's a big deal because obesity management until now, we didn't have a ton of agents. And it was kind of like, okay, well, these are the agents that we have. Just pick one, like whatever you want. Try it. If it doesn't work, try something else. And so I appreciate that the guidelines are saying here, we know these are the most effective. These are first line. Go ahead, use one of these agents. And so I thought that I was happy to see that.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that it is, again, the ADA leads you to where we need to be. And now the evidence is mounting with other benefits, right? I mean, we talked about this in another episode too, the weekly semaglutide and the reduction in cardiovascular risk in people without diabetes, right? So those are weight, people that are taking it for weight alone, there was, you know, a significant reduction in cardiovascular risk. So we need to then say, the ADA needs to say as clinicians, let's guide people to using these first because of that outcome. You know, we all sometimes want ADA to make a decision. You should say this now and hurry up. And why is it taking so long? But if there's not evidence, if there's not true evidence, ADA won't do it. We have to wait for the evidence to present. And this year, we've gotten really good evidence to say, and enough of it to say, okay, these should be first line. And I'm excited because they, you know, it's not, there's some of the other medications you can take for a little bit, but then you have to come off of it and you can do this, but you can't do that. And there's all these rules and kinds of, these are medications you should be on, and that you really need to remember that these people are on these medications for life. Just like they take a statin, I don't stop my statin because my cholesterol gets better, right? These are lifelong medications because this is actually the 10th year anniversary of obesity, the American Medical Association recognizing obesity as a disease. So it was 10 years ago this year that they recognized it as a disease. We're still trying to get people to recognize it as a disease. Now the ADA is, as a leader, has said, let's go. Not only is it a disease, but we treat it with these medications first.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. This section is actually endorsed by the Obesity Society. And there's also a lot more, the ADA has made such an effort to have more person-first language, which it's really done throughout the years. But I think especially in this section this year, there's been more of an emphasis, person first language, person with overweight or obesity, and just getting away from shame, blame, like this is considered a chronic condition, and we treat it just like we treat others. Also, I just want to specify, so even though the incretins are the first line preferred pharmacotherapy, of course, ADA discusses in great depth the importance of a team-based approach, of lifestyle modifications, of healthy eating, physical activity, the importance of sleep, managing stress. So it is not just give a drug and your obesity goes away. It truly is a holistic approach. But I think it's exciting that now, at least medication-wise, we have better tools to bring to the table along with that whole holistic approach.
Absolutely. I think that you know, even the studies that the individual drug companies have done on the different drugs, always, the overall weight loss is improved when a holistic approach is used, when a dietitian, when depending on what's going, you know, exercise physiologist, whoever else is involved in the study, always there is more weight loss than in a just give the drug. In our department, that's never the answer.
Yeah, I totally agree. And speaking of that holistic approach, so we've known for a long time that BMI, body mass index, has several limitations. And you always hear like someone's like, oh, my BMI is 29. It puts me in overweight, but they're super muscular and great fitness. And so we know BMI just, it does not give the full picture. And so one of the other additions to the standards this year was really incorporating more of these other types of measurements in addition to just BMI. And so some of those things include, for example, waist circumference, waist to hip ratio, waist to height ratio, and kind of other anthropometric measurements. And so like looking at body fat, for example. And so I think that's going to be important, especially also when you add therapies like these incretin agents, right? We want to make sure people aren't losing muscle or not losing tons of muscle mass, right? Ideally, we want to be losing the fat percentage. And so I think these other measurements will be really important, both for initiating therapy and for monitoring in the long term.
I absolutely agree, right? And it's one of those where you get someone very fit. I think about bodybuilders, and not these super muscular, but even a little bit. Someone goes to the gym 3 days a week and they've got a decent amount of muscle. Those people can, BMI-wise, come in at BMI of 32 and have a percent of body fat at 6%. And so that makes no sense that they're considered obese. And so, you know, we need to, as clinicians, have other options. And I think, again, in the beginning, it was an easy way to start. To look at someone and say, where do they fall in a classification? But just like everything else, we look at an A1C and say, you know, an A1C for my mother at 7.5% might be at goal. But if it were my diabetes, 7.5 because of my age wouldn't be at goal. Same thing with BMI, right? So we need to look at BMI, but also consider what else is happening to that person. How much muscle do they have? Are they able to walk a long distance? Do they have cardiovascular health? And again, as we look at these weight loss medications, I think that we're going to have more opportunity to say, where is the percent of body fat? Is it in the, and what is their risk due to that, right? So this is, I think, going to, in the next couple of years, really explode, and a new way of looking at someone differently and helping them with their own goals.
I totally agree. Well, this has been amazing discussion. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, and we hope to catch you next time.